Chapter 1. Go tell the Spartans, passerby, that here the 300 lie, obedient to their commands.
Near Asheville, North Carolina, United States of America, Sol 3, 02 1500 hours EDT, Monday, September 28, 2009 AD. Major Michael O'Neill checked the holographic schematic he had thrown up and nodded at the Banshee bank to the right and dropped. Now the fun started. The shuttle he was riding in looked like a black scimitar scything across the cloudy Appalachian sky. The combination of human, Endowie, Hemet technology had created something that was neither the best nor the worst of the three worlds. A ship that was somewhat stealthy, somewhat armored, somewhat maneuverable, and somewhat fast. Of course, compared to anything from pure human technology, the Banshee 3 was a marvel beyond words. The stealth shuttles had an uneventful voyage until reaching the area of the southern Shenandoah. There, the puzzling invaders, who held virtually all of the Atlantic and Pacific seaboard, had made an incursion in the area of Staunton. And that required the scimitar-shaped ships to drop to below the level of horizon and begin evasive maneuvers. Over the past 5 years, the Posleen had landed in waves throughout the world, overrunning virtually every defense. The few survivors of Western Europe were now huddled in the Alps, eking out a wretched existence among those upland valleys. The Middle East, Africa, most of South America were either in Posleen hands or in such a state of anarchy, not even radio communications were coming out. The only survivors in Australia were in the far western territories and roaming the desert interior in a post-apocalyptic nightmare. China had been lost only after losing nearly 1,000 nuclear weapons in the long retreat up the Yangtze Valley. Others survived in the highlands of the world, holding passes against the enemy. But few of those scattered groups were a coherent defense. Everywhere, one by one, the civilizations of the world had fallen to the remorseless invaders, with one small exception. In the United States, a combination of geographic luck, the Posleen tended to land in coastal plains, and the U.S. had defendable terrain features inward of all these coastal plains. And frankly, logistics and political preparation had permitted the U.S. government to retain control, to retain a condition of domestic harmony in a few areas. Of these, the most vital were the Cumberland and Ohio basins due to their industrial might and breadth of agricultural resources. The vast plains of central Canada were still safe, and would remain so as long as the Posleen were resisted at all, for the Posleen were almost incapable of fighting in snow. But those plains in the various western areas in human control, ranging from the Sierra Madre to the Canadian Rockies, could produce only a small number of crops, mostly grains. Furthermore, there was little or no industrial infrastructure in comparison to the might found in the Cumberland and Ohio. The Cumberland, the Ohio, and the Great Lakes regions were the heart and soul of the defense of the United States. Losing the Cumberland, furthermore, would open up all of that to conquest. And with one thrust, the Posleen had placed all of that in jeopardy. For years, the major blow had been expected at Chattanooga, where little would stand in the way of a breakout. This battalion and others had defended the cities that were scattered down the range of the Appalachians, each of them, at one time or another, assaulted in force by the enemy. Only a few weeks before, the battalion had been in a hair-raising battle on the Ontario Plain. But this time, the Posleen had surprised everyone, striking an unnoticed and lightly defended sector and throwing the defense of the entire eastern U.S. into flux. O'Neill and his forces had passed over southern Pennsylvania and through West Virginia without incident. But now, approaching the jumbled mess of western Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee, it was time to get down and busy. From this point forward, the Posleen were pressing hard or were already over the Appalachian Wall. The battalion would actually be forced to fly between two Posleen thrusts. Besides the attack through the gap, the Posleen were pressing in on two flanks of Asheville. If the Posleen were able to reach the embattled city from the rear, the end would be assured. On that flank, the mountains above Waynesville would be the key, but they were a problem for others. The only thing the 1st Battalion 555th Infantry had to worry about was surviving as a plug. O'Neill nodded again as another turn was faintly sensed. The shuttles used just a touch of inertial compensation to reduce the impact of their course corrections. Too much, and they stood out like light bulbs to the Pauseline. Too little, and they smashed their passengers into jelly. Mike switched to an external view, and by the light of the waxing moon, he could see the mountains flashing by overhead. The ships were down in the valley, following its wandering path, and only the occasional shudder passed through to the humans. Soon they began to ascend, traveling at over 500 knots and not much more than 100 feet off the ground. The shuttles rapidly shot to the top of the next ridgeline and then, in a maneuver that looked flatly impossible, dropped down to the backside in exact parallel with the slope. At no time did their speed increase or slow. It stayed a constant 50 kilometers per hour under the ambient speed of sound. Mike noted another checkpoint and looked off to the left. Somewhere out there was Asheville, awaiting the dawn of a new day, a city still inhabited by over 1 million civilians and 6 divisions of infantry. Behind it were 2 sub-urbs, with a combined total of 5 million souls, and all of it was in the vice of a nutcracker. He sighed and brought up a collection of tunes. A little music seemed appropriate at a time like this. Might as well share the misery. What the hell is that? Tommy asked as a strange keyboard melody started on the command override frequency. Don't pay the ferryman, SPC Blatt said. The Reaper's armor had a purple and pink holographic teddy bear on the front of it, and when the music started, the bear jumped to its feet to dance, shaking its fat little belly in time to the music. The old man must really be depressed. The Grim Reapers were the heavy weapon suits of the ACS. They were designed for long-range, indirect fire, or heavy-duty close-in support and generally carried 4 weapons, versus the standard 1 rifle of the Marauders. These might range from anti-ship heavy grav cannons to long-range auto-mortars to flechette cannons capable of spewing millions of rounds per minute. Their suits were bulkier and slower than the standard Marauder suits, looking a bit more fat-bellied than the muscle look of the Marauders, but given that most of their weapons had much higher ammunition bulk than the Marauders, that was all to the good. The flip side was that their armor was lighter, so getting into direct fights with the Pauseline was usually a losing proposition. Christ, PFC McAvoy cursed, rubbing at his nearly bald head. He detached the gauntlets of his suit, and his hand made a rasping sound over the short, thick stubble. He leaned forward as far as he could and looked to the doors at the front of the compartment. I hope it's not that whole "We're All Gonna Die" playlist. If I hear "Veteran of the Psychic Wars" one more time, I'm gonna puke. The shuttles were small, designed to carry 36 troopers and 2 leaders in no particular comfort. Each suit segment was rigid, with clamps to hold the suits in place against the worst possible maneuvering, and designed to swivel and fire the troopers out into a hostile environment. This did not make for the most comfortable seating. Nah, Blatt replied. James Taylor next. Betcha 5 creds. Sucker bet, McAvoy replied. I hear his daughter was in the gap. Ah, fuck me, Blatt said, shaking his head. That sucks. She's tough, McAvoy said, leaning forward to spit into his helmet. So's his dad, from what I hear. But they might make it. That is questionable, Sunday said, looking up from his hologram. According to seismographic and EM readings, there have been multiple nuclear detonations in the area of the gap, and we're about to make the area extremely unpleasant ourselves. I didn't think we'd open up the nukes yet, sir, Black commented. He started to put his gauntlets back on as a timer in his suit tinged. 20 minutes. We have recently, Tommy answered, putting on his helmet, but these appear to be secondary explosions. Oh, that's okay then, Blatt said, as long as they're not targeted on us or anything. Yeah, McAvoy agreed. The last time I worried about nukes was the first time I got hit by them. Any suggestions? The lieutenant asked. Lay flat, Blatt said with a laugh. Yeah, getting tossed through the air is the worst part. I'd think having your arms and legs ripped off would be the worst part, Tommy commented. Well, the only one who survived from that close is the old man, sir, Blatt pointed out. You don't want to be that close. Getting an arm blown off smarts. Agreed, Tommy said, but been there, done that. The lieutenant was new to their armored combat suits, but not to battle. Up until a few weeks before, he had been an NCO in the 10,000, the most elite unit short of the suits. The 10,000 was armed with captured Pozzoline weapons and other devices and shuttled from crisis to crisis. Thus, in his time in the unit, Tom Sunday Jr. had seen more than any trooper short of the ACS, and he had managed to survive and raise in rank to staff sergeant, all of which spoke for his versatility and ability to take cover when the shit hit the fan. But even the best soldier tended to run out of the law of averages from time to time. "Which one, Lieutenant?" McAvoy asked. The offer was new to them, and they hadn't had much time to get to know him. "Right just above the elbow," the lieutenant said. With his helmet on, it was impossible to tell where he was looking, but McAvoy was pretty sure it was directly at him. "Ah," the Reaper said. "Just asking." "You're right," the lieutenant said. "It smarts. So does taking a shotgun fletched in the chest, or getting your right kidney taken out by a 3mm that was, fortunately, going too fast to do much damage. And getting caught in your own company's mortar fire sucks. So does getting shot in the back by a cherry radio man who panics. All in all, I imagine it's really unpleasant to get blown through the air by a nuclear explosion." "I guess so, sir," the gunner said, swinging his heavy grav gun from side to side to ensure it tracked smoothly. "All things considered, I guess wearing armor is the way to go." "Ah, hell," Blatt said, changing the subject. "It looks like you were right. Here we go with Veteran of the Psychic Wars." "He's something pissed at those Pozzoline," McAvoy said. "I'm not sure he's the only one," Sunday said quietly. Captain Ann Elgars looked at the motley group gathered around the small fire and sighed. The captain appeared to be about 17 and had heavily muscled body with long strawberry blonde hair. She was, in fact, nearer to 30 than 20, and had until recently been in a coma. Her recovery from the coma, the musculature, odd skills, and personality quirks that had arisen from the recovery were mysteries that were only starting to be illuminated. There were two other adult females, two soldiers, and a group of 8 children in the small wooded dell tucked into the North Carolina mountains. The women and children had been in a suburb, an underground city, when the Pozzoline struck the Raben Valley and swiftly pushed most of the defenders aside. Through a combination of luck and ruthlessness, the three women had reached the deepest areas of the herb, intending to escape through the service areas, when they happened upon a hidden installation tucked into the herb. It was there that they had been upgraded, their wounds repaired and imparted with both increased strength and some basic weaponry skills. They had also found an escape route. Trying to make their way to human-controlled areas, they had first been cut off by the advancing Pozzoline and then encountered two soldiers, Jake Mosevich and David Mueller. Now the question was, where to go now that the easy route was closed? "It's agreed," Elgars asked, her breath ghosting white in the frigid air. "We'll head for the O'Neill farm and raid the cache." "Don't see any choice," Mueller replied. He was a bear of a man, not only tall but wider in proportion, with a thin shock of almost white blonde hair. The master sergeant had been running around snooping on Pozzoline since before the first invasion, and he had regularly found his ass in a crack enough times that he frequently asked himself why in the hell he kept doing it. But none of the other times did he have to worry about getting 3 women and 7 children out of the crack. And in this case, the crack included that the children, at least, were likely to die of exposure if something wasn't done. There wasn't anything to use at the hydrological station. The Pozzoline raided for loot and destroyed every trace of previous habitation. While the station hadn't been leveled, it had been emptied, and had every other building they had checked. Sherry Riley grimaced. "It's still nearly 15 miles, she said. "Even carrying the kids, I don't see how we can make it." Sherry had been 32, a waitress, and single mother of 3 when the Pozzoline dropped on her hometown in Fredericksburg, Virginia. She was one of the very few survivors from that town and was resettled along with all 3 children in one of the first underground cities. They had been placed in an out-of-the-way valley in the western North Carolina, despite a lack of roads to supply it, for 2 reasons. It was unlikely the Pozzoline would attack into such rugged country, and the local congressman was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. As it turned out, after 5 years of battering their heads everywhere else, the Pozzoline did attack up the Raben Valley. And Sherry Riley had, again, been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Story of her life, really. I'd like to find out what happened to Callie and Papa O'Neill, Sherry admitted. The group had previously visited the O'Neill family farm, and she and Papa O'Neill had gotten along very well. Oh, very well to the point that he had asked her and the children to come live with him. With the Pazline having overrun the area, that plan, like so many others in her life, had been nipped in the bud. But she still felt it necessary to find out what happened to the O'Neills. Wendy Cummings shrugged and shook her head, pulling a lock of hair out of the way. "We're still in the same boat," she said, gesturing at the gray skies. In the last few hours, the sky had begun to darken. While the women, with their new upgrades, could probably survive the environment, the children were without any shelter or heavy clothing. Getting them both was the second highest priority, the highest being to keep them out of the hands of the Pazline. Wendy was the main point of contact between the two other women, and sometimes she felt like the only thing holding the group together. She was a well-endowed blonde, another survivor of Fredericksburg, who had until recently been stymied in her desire to go off and kill Pazline like her boyfriend was doing. She was doing it now, whenever the Pazline came in view, but killing Pazline while carting kids around took all the fun out of it. Still, a mission was a mission. "We need to get the kids some clothes, and we could use some supplies," she continued, gesturing at the two soldiers. "Even with what the Sergeant Major and Mueller supplied, it's not enough." "There was plenty in the cache," Mueller noted. He slid a little more dry wood into the fire and looked up at the sky. "If we move fast, we can make it to the O'Neill house by midnight." "Later," Masovich replied. The Sergeant Major was the antithesis of his subordinate, slight and wiry. But he had been beating around the bush when Mueller wasn't even a gleam in his father's eye and could carry loads that were frankly astonishing. What he would not do in these conditions was lie. "Even with their girls' improvement, we can't carry all the kids that far. And in a few hours, it's going to start raining. Cold rain. And by morning, we might be looking at sleet. Do you think we should try something else?" Mueller asked. "No, but we're not going to make it there before morning." The sergeant major looked at the children and shook his head. "We'll try like hell, but we won't make it." "We'll make it," Elger said, getting to her feet. "But not if we debate about it all day. Sergeant Major, I'm apparently the ranking officer, but I don't know what the hell I'm doing. How are we going to handle that?" "Well, ma'am," the recon specialist said with a faint grin, "I'll make suggestions and you give the orders. And if you don't give the orders I suggest, you better have a goddamn reason or I'll shoot you." "Works for me," she said with a laugh. "And your suggestion is?" "Let's move out," he replied. "It's not going to get any easier as it gets darker."
"Can I just say one thing?" Sherry asked.
"Sure."
"I really hate the Pazline."
As they started off, a gentle cold mist began to fall. Tulo Stenelor cursed and shook his crest. The senior commander of the Pazline forces assaulting Rabun Gap had been fighting the humans for nigh on 10 years. And over the time, he had developed a healthy respect for their abilities. Outnumbered though they were, outgunned though they were, the humans were clever about using well-honed skills and an almost devilish ingenuity to defeat the assaults of the Pazline. But the current group was really starting to annoy him.
"I hate humans," he grumped. "What do we know of this cursed middle Threshkin unit?"
The Pazline had first met the humans at the planet Aradan V, what the humans called Dice. Up until that encounter, the advance of the host had been continuous and without major check. There were three races that they had encountered in near space, and none of them, not the little green Endowi, nor the taller slim Darhel, nor the Insectile, would give fight. Sometimes the Darhel would fight, but not well and not long. Mostly it was a matter of simply rounding them up and butchering them for dinner. Until Aradan V. Tulo Stenelor had been there when the host had met its first defeat. It had been a nightmare. Each time they thought they had the humans defeated, something had hit them from a different direction. It was necessary to dig the humans out like a bat or grat, and they stung worse. The host had taken fantastic damage before a unit of these demons-be-damned metal Threshkreen had arisen from the ocean of the world and destroyed his first Ultundai. He still remembered the unholy destruction visited upon his fine collection of genetic specialists, ripped to shreds in bare seconds. Other Threshkreen, who had its first fled before the host, had stopped and formed a wall of fire that seemed unbreakable. Faced with an implacable foe to the side and an impossible foe to the front, the host had fled. He had barely escaped with his life, limping off-planet in a simple in-system ship, and it had taken him years to recover from that debacle. "It's led by a human named Michael O'Neill, who's one of their Kessonaut, the term the humans use as a hero, or elite. And this is their finest group of metal Threshkreen." Generally, other species in Pazleen that had become too injured or too old to be of use were referred to simply as Thresh, or food. Threshkreen was food that stung. All humans should be called Threshkreen. Even their nestlings fought. "Do we know their plan? We need to push as many Ultos through the pass as we can. We cannot afford to be trapped here." "They intend to open up the area with nuclear bombardment," the S2 answered.
"What? Why didn't you tell me?"
"The area they will be able to cover is limited," the intelligence officer pointed out. "They will be firing ballistic systems from the northern regions and from the sea. Few of them can even be targeted on this area, and most will be destroyed by Ultposol. So all of them are targeted on a relatively small area. Given that most of the blast will be trapped by these accursed hills, we should take minimal casualties. They intend to land in this area forward of the original defenses where Mountain City once stood. Their fire will only fill the gap in that mountain and the immediate areas to the pass. So we'll lose less than 2 Ultendai? That's fine. But we need a response, a counterattack, as the humans would use. Prepare one of the Leet Ultendai and all of the remaining Tenoral for an assault upon them as soon as they're on the ground, and 2 Ultpoos. We're almost out of trained forces, the S2 pointed out. I'm aware of that. But if we can't keep this pass open until others are breached, it'll be all for nothing. We need to crush these metal Threshkreen before they can get dug in, or we'll be trying to kill them 2 days from now. Have the Ultendar move immediately to the hills above the landing zone, in this gap where they will be out of danger from the heavy fire. Tell them to wait to attack until the unit lands and is in the process of unloading. The humans are in 2 groups, Estinar. They have 2 resupply shuttles filled with antimatter following them. That should be an interesting target, Tulus Dainalor said with a rise in his crest. Have the Ultendai wait until those shuttles land in particular, but ensure that they are struck. That is most important. Very well, Estinar, the officer replied. What shall we tell Orostan?
Nothing for now.
He has his own problems, and more than enough forces at the moment. It is when he hits resistance that he will need those passing through right now. Get the Ultendar moving immediately. Ensure they are heavily weaponed. As the humans would say, they must load for bear. Callie O'Neill looked at the back and shook her head. She wanted to load for bear, but there was just too much to carry. She had spent half the night curled up in a ball, alternately sleeping fitfully and waking up to cry. She wasn't very good at crying. It really ticked her off when she did. But she had a lot to cry about. When the word of the Pazleen invasion had come, both of her parents were recalled to duty. Because her mother was considered off-planet, Callie's older sister, Michelle, had been moved to safety on a distant Indawi world. Callie had been left behind in the care of her grandfather on the family farm in Rabun County in North Georgia. The farm just happened to be about 5 miles on the good side of the eastern U.S. line of defense. The Pazleen had hit the wall several times over the last few years, but this was the first time they had ever succeeded in breaching it. Now they were all over the place, and she was alone in a friggin' cave, behind the lines and without the comfort and advice, not to mention combat support, of Papa O'Neill. It was not the Pazleen who killed Papa, though at least not directly. Something had hit one of the landers when it was passing over their valley, and the antimatter containment system had failed. The explosion, equivalent to 100 kiloton nuke, had come as she was moving back into the deeper shelters. But Papa O'Neill had been in the outer bunker. She found him later, or at least an arm, which was far down as she could dig, but it was still and cold. She had covered it back up and headed to Cache 4, where she had spent the night. The cache had everything a person on the run could need, Papa O'Neill had spent plenty of time opening up Viet Cong tunnels, and he knew what the best ones stocked. He had simply updated the list to the times. The first thing she donned was her body armor. The class AAA armor was custom-made. Nobody made body armor for 13-year-old girls, but she carried it without thought. She had spent so much time already in her life in body armor, it was like second skin. The armor was studded with pouches for ammunition and grenades, and they were all filled. The base of the armor had latch points for more equipment, and she had a holstered Colt 44 Magnum on one side and a combat knife on the other. The 44 was a revolver. She just didn't have the wrists for a Desert Eagle yet, but she was nearly as quick with a speed loader as most people were with a magazine. She also had two quart canteens. They would supplement the camelback built into the back of the armor, and a butt pack with an absolute minimal of survival materials. In the pouches, she had her basic load, 180 rounds of 7.62, 5 fragmentation grenades, 5 white phosphorus grenades, and 2 smoke. She probably wouldn't have an opportunity to use the smoke, but if she needed it, she would need it bad. With the armor, pistol, ammunition pouches, and grenades, she was already looking at over 45 pounds, which was half her body weight. Around her neck, she had a set of night vision goggles. They were lightweight and had binocular zoom capability with both optical and electronic. As such, they had it all over standard helmet monoculars, but with the weapon sights, she wasn't sure she should carry them. And the helmet she had just put on seemed like an unnecessary extravagance. Papa O'Neill was always adamant about it when they were going in hot against Pazleen, but if she was on the move, she wasn't sure she could afford the extra weight. She thought about Papa O'Neill and a lump rose in her throat. He had always seemed invincible, immortal. He had fought in just about every brush fire war that existed for nearly 2 decades, then came back to the farm when his father died. With her mother dead and dad off with the ACS, he had been all she had, and for him, it seemed like a chance to make up for the never being there when her father grew up. He had taught her intensively from the first day she arrived, and she, in turn, had been an apt pupil. Demolitions, close combat, long-distance shooting, she had taken to all of it as if only having to be reminded. It had seemed a very odd pair to the few people that knew them, the ancient mercenary and his tow-headed granddaughter, and jokes had been made carefully out of his hearing about the farmer's daughter. The jokes had tended to die, though rather than increase, as she blossomed and turned into a real Appalachian belle, albeit one that walked around with a panther's stride and a pistol on her hip. And they had stopped, or at least changed fundamentally, after she shot the sergeant major. The command sergeant major of the 105th had been quite taken by the 12-year-old beauty in the hardware store. So taken that he finally trapped her in the nuts and bolts section, which at the time he thought very appropriate. When a simple "go away" had been insufficient, and when the fat old soldier had his hand down her newly filling blouse, Callie had simply drawn her Walther and shot him in the knee, then walked away while he rolled around the ground, screaming like he'd actually been hurt or something. It wasn't like it was the first time she shot a man, and the other time had been far messier. An assassin, an acquaintance of Papa O'Neill from his Phoenix days, but young again courtesy of a bootleg rejuvenation, had come recruiting. When it was clear that Papa O'Neill was uninterested in becoming a hired gun for whatever shadowy group Harold had represented, it was also clear that the assassin had revealed too much to let them continue breathing. Callie had realized things were going wrong when Papa's right hand had started twitching like he was reaching for a gun that wasn't there, a sure sign of agitation that she had used to good effect while playing poker against him. Aware that things were about to go from bad to worse, and dismissed by the normally paranoid assassin as an irrelevant 8-year-old loose end that would soon be tied up, she shot the visitor in the back of the head while he was drawing on Papa O'Neill. Therefore, shooting a fat old sergeant major was no big deal, a point that she made to the judge without reference to the previous shooting, which had, fortunately, never come to the attention of the authorities. Her self-possession was almost her undoing. The sergeant major was vociferously defending himself on the not inconceivable charge that she had propositioned him and then shot him when he wanted too low a price. In fact, he was trying very hard to get her charged with attempted murder. However, Callie quickly demonstrated that if she wanted to kill him, she would have done so with ease.
and no one could be found to back up the sergeant major's assertions about extracurricular activities. In the end, the former sergeant major found himself in a penal battalion, and Callie's picture was circulated around all the nearby military encampments, where it made a nice pin-up with the caption, "Warning, jailbait, armed and dangerous." She hadn't had much self-possession after finding Papa O'Neill's body. She had covered the arm back up and stumbled to the cache to cry her heart out. But as the night went on, she'd recognized that she had to leave. There was a full-blown battle going on to the north from the sounds of it, and the Pazleen flowing through the gap were spreading out. She had to head to the human lines, or at least find somewhere further away to hide. The Pazleen would pass by something like the cache at first, but later they would come back and dig like badgers if there were any sign of materials or people. So she started to pack. She didn't know how long she would be moving, so she had to take food. And the nights were getting colder, so she needed some snival gear. Papa O'Neill could probably do with just a poncho liner, but she really wasn't nearly as tough or well-insulated as the old soldier. So she packed a sleeping bag, extra water, fuel tabs, spare ammo. There was just too much. Even with what she packed, if she was in the woods more than 5 days, things would start to get hard. She stared at the pile, unsure what to take and what to leave, until the floor flipped up and hit her in the face.